Persons listening to this show should experience varying degrees of euphoria and might radiate a warm glow of truth from their entire being. This phenomenon sometimes lasts hours after a typical brain massage. If you are listening with another lights on listener and they begin to glow, don't be concerned. This is a phenomenon normally associated with Pastor Scheidbach's patented brain massage technique and merely means the truth has set them free. Devil beware. Pastor Scheidbach is on the air.
Hello, I'm Jerry Scheidbach, pastor at the Lighthouse and your brain masseur. Get ready for your brain massage.
Truth served here, flavored with delectable wit, succulent sagacity, luscious logic, a gourmet meal for the mind.
Malaysian flight MH17 was shot down by pro-Russian Ukrainians who are at war against Ukraine to subjugate Ukraine to Russia. You probably have heard the translator recording of GRU Russian intelligence officers discussing with some of their operatives among the separatists how they downed the passenger airliner. And it seems clear one of the minor groups, which is a translation of a term used to identify a pro-Russian separatist cell, did indeed intentionally shoot down the plane. But it's also obvious they were surprised to discover it was a passenger jet after all, and not, as they thought, a Ukrainian cargo plane, which planes have been identified as military targets by the separatists. Now, folks, of course, the numbers are being updated as this story develops. The source I have at hand, a Wall Street Journal article posted on the 18th at 9:28 a.m., put the dead at 283 plus 15 crew, or 298 killed. Early reports indicated 23 of these were Americans, but this report shows only one, a dual U.S.-Dutch citizen, Schansman. I'm not sure exactly how to pronounce it. Perhaps this is the American Obama has recently identified as the one American being on board that plane. It was on its way to Perth in Australia, carrying over 100 AIDS research scientists, who I believe were all going to attend some sort of conference or something on AIDS in Aussieland. I think it was called an AIDS Summit or whatever. One of these was world-renowned AIDS activist. All of them died. A Dutch senator was killed in this attack. Most who were killed in this flight were from the Netherlands, at least 189 passengers from that country alone. And by the way, I have listeners in the Netherlands, and my heart aches with yours. What are the key questions here? We might ask, how could such a ginormous mistake be made with today's level of technology? But the answer to that is likely to be those firing this missile did not have that level of tech support necessary to verify the target quickly enough before they launched their attack. And these type of situations do occur in war. And so the obvious question becomes, what exactly was the Malaysian airline thinking when they routed this flight over a war zone? My son's first question was, what in the world was that airline doing flying over a war zone? What were they thinking to route a passenger plane over what is known by everyone to be a war zone, where, as a matter of fact, it was also known they were shooting down planes? Second to that might be, what did Obama do when he heard the news? Well, everyone knows the answer to that. He went to a fundraiser. When Benghazi was going down, he had to get his beauty sleep, man, because the next day he had a big gig in Las Vegas for a fundraiser. And when he heard about the attack on this passenger jet over the Ukraine, he didn't miss a step. He went right on with his fundraising business. I mean, he has certainly earned the nickname Fundraiser in Chief. One thing, though, I mean, if you secure a promise from Obama to be at a fundraiser, now you can count on him being there. That is one thing you can count on with this president. He will never miss a fundraiser engagement. Now, some are contrasting Obama's response to this with Reagan's response to the 1983 attack on another passenger airline by the Soviets, KAL, or K-A-L, Korean Airlines, 007, that wandered into Soviet airspace. I remember the tension that gripped America on that day. Reagan immediately ended his California vacation and flew right back to D.C. and, of course, spent all of his time working on this problem. He called his cabinet together, went into war room readiness, and began working on a proper American response to all of it, and then went on national television and said, quote, "This was the Soviet Union against the world and the moral precepts which guide human relations among people everywhere." It was an act of barbarism, born of a society which wantonly disregards individual rights and human life and seeks constantly to expand and dominate other nations, end quote. It's true, some expected more from Reagan. Some expected he would ratchet up sanctions, that he would perhaps even threaten or begin to prepare for military action. They were angry that he did not stop grain sales to Russia, for example. And many were angry that he continued his arms reduction negotiations with Russia in the aftermath of that egregious attack. But Reagan didn't believe making the Russian people go hungry would do anything at all to deter the Politburo from pursuing their wicked agenda of the evil empire. He felt that would in fact play into their hands. He also knew that the Soviets, then as now, are extremely sensitive to world opinion, and he really had them pinned with this one. I mean, they had egg all over their face. They were much more willing to negotiate reasonably after Reagan went on the offensive and used the atrocity of their behavior as an illustration to the world of what he had been saying about them all along, calling them the evil empire. Obama, on the other hand, well, yeah, he's a multitasker, man. Hey, why should he let minor events like Benghazi and this downing of MH17, why should that interfere with his truly important work of fundraising? What a world. Obama's world. Israel under attack and aggressively fighting back this time, thank God. And that with a full-blown invasion into Gaza going on right now. And the South American invasion right now across our borders. Who knows? Maybe Obama is secretly somewhat relieved to get these things off his back and off the front page for a few days. I wonder if this president does not actually just hide in these fundraisers, uses them as a way to hide from his responsibilities. I mean, they are so important to him because, in fact, it's something he's competent to do. It's the one thing where he has some competency. He can command a fundraiser. It fits him. It's a task for which he's well-suited. All this being president stuff, you know, so overwhelming. He needs the simplicity of a fundraiser, something he can handle. I mean, think about it. You got South America invading America, overwhelming our borders with cartels and coyotes cashing in on statements he has made about his policy not to enforce immigration laws regarding illegal migrants. At the same time, Israel, under constant missile assault from Gaza, unrelenting, sometimes well over 100 in a single day, all because of statements, all encouraged by statements from this White House regarding his policies on Middle East politics and his displays of disdain for Israel, saying effectively, America's not going to have Israel's back, so go ahead and stab it. Make no mistake about this, my friend. The Canadian Prime Minister sees it. He did everything but call Obama out on his nonsensical calls for Israel to act with restraint in response to the unrelenting missile attack on Israeli civilian targets by Hamas. Why does he tell the Hamas to act with restraint? Canada's calling for solidarity with Israel during this crisis. But Obama, well, he's saying to Israel, he shakes his finger at Israel. I call on Israel to use restraint. And by the way, I've got to go. I've got a fundraiser to attend to. So Obama publicly declares he will not enforce immigration laws and demonstrates he will do everything, even manipulate the law, and go so far as even to break the law to virtually end any control of our borders. And this results in hundreds of thousands of children being recruited by the cartels and the coyotes, using Obama's own words in the recruiting program to overwhelm the borders so they can use this as cover to carry on their illegal activities, exploiting America's ambivalence over what to do with the kids. A survey conducted by our government, Obama's administration, on behalf of Homeland Security et al., found that, quote, of the 230 migrants interviewed, 219 cited the primary reason for migrating to the United States was the perception of U.S. immigration laws granting free passes or permisos to UAC, that's unaccompanied children, and adult female OTMs other than Mexicans traveling with minors. Meanwhile, the cartels are sneaking gang members into the country by the dozens and getting their drugs and guns across the borders much more easily in all the confusion while our border agents are completely distracted and preoccupied with all of this. Evil always takes full advantage of lawlessness. Obama's responsible for what is going on at the borders right now, either because he's inept or because he's corrupt. He and the Mexican government and other South American governments that are doing nothing, by the way, to stem this invasion, well, they're all aiding and abetting the evil designs of lawbreakers Because that's what refusal to enforce the law does. It encourages and strengthens evil. Bible thump alert, Bible thump alert. Quote, because sentence against an evil work is not executed speedily, therefore the heart of the sons of men is fully set in them to do evil. Ecclesiastes 8:11. Yeah, Obama's an evil facilitator. And you can play with a double entendre as you please. He facilitates evil. His lawlessness encourages lawlessness, strengthens it, supports it, and exposes all under his influence and authority to greater lawlessness and therefore greater evil. He refuses to enforce laws. Well, that opens the door to all sorts of evils, many of which he might not even be aware. But it's like a law of gravity, man. Throw it up, it comes down. Obama can't break or countermand it. If you fail to enforce the law, you open the door to all the evil that is being blocked by that law or restrained by it. Look at the evil that is rising in the world under Obama's watch. It's amazing. Israel is under greater assault by terrorists than ever before. The evil empire is beginning to rise and assert itself. Our own borders are collapsing, and under cover of all this distraction, Iran is racing to become a terrorist state with nukes. Now, every one of these developments is being aided and abetted by Obama's lawless approach to governing. Now, when I get back, folks, I want to offer a biblical perspective on this border issue. Hold on to the break. I'll be right back.
Folks, I can see right now that my second segment is going to run a little long. So we're going to roll on through the break.
Stand
and
by.
Continue.
The Brain Massage Show is about to blow your mind.
Hello, folks. Welcome back. I'm Jerry Scheidbach, pastor of the Lighthouse, your brain masseur, and Paul Revere's lantern lighter, lighting the lamps in the church belfry, arch singling the enemies on the march, an enemy that would steal from us our liberties. What is a proper Christian response to the border crisis? In past shows, I've talked about what the Bible says is our responsibility as Christians regarding strangers, which is the word used in the Bible to identify outsiders, you know, people who come amongst us who are not of us or part of our community or nation. Biblically, a stranger is to be regarded with respect, and we are to be hospitable. In fact, we are warned to be careful how we entertain strangers because we could be entertaining angels unaware. The Sodomites of Sodom and Gomorrah discovered this a little late. Har har. God reminded the Jews that they were once strangers in a strange land and should therefore remember not to oppress strangers. Now you find that in Exodus 22:21. I won't recite all the verses. Call in for my notes here and it gives you all the references. Furthermore, we are strictly commanded to extend to strangers the protection of our laws and the courtesies of our customs. With regard to our laws, you'll notice Leviticus 24:22, quote, ye shall have one manner of law, as well for the stranger as for one of your own country. For I am the Lord your God, end quote. And as for customs, for example, the rules to set aside a portion of your fields, you know, say income, to minister to the poor, is specifically to include the poor among the strangers in the land. That's Leviticus 23:22 and so on. Now, however, this applied both ways. In other words, the strangers were obliged to keep the laws and honor the customs of the Jewish people. And this included the Sabbath laws and other ordinances. I mean, you read through Exodus and Leviticus and Deuteronomy, and you'll see this over and over and over again. The restrictions against eating blood, for example, applied to nationals, but also to any strangers within their borders. So the point here is that if a stranger comes here, he's expected to abide by our laws and to honor and respect our customs, not the other way around. All right? You want some Bible on this? There you go. Furthermore, if a stranger comes here illegally, that is, not according to our laws, then they are criminals and should be treated like any criminal would be treated, and it would be according to the law. Now, there's a way to come here as a stranger according to our laws. And I have often spoken to my own frustration and with some personal experience in this matter with people in my church and so on, the ridiculous obstacles that are put in place to frustrate legal immigration. And I've asked you to consider with me, what does it mean that it seems the Democrats always want to focus on breaking down our laws governing illegal migration, but they never want to do anything about the obstacles that our own laws put in the way of legal migration? I want you to think about that. Folks, make legal migration sensible, accessible. Obviously, like the flow of traffic onto freeways at certain times of the day down south, is helped significantly by these lights they put up there to make you stop and wait and then come in, metering the traffic, as they call it, to merge into the traffic. Well, there has to be some control over the whole process of migration, or it will become all jammed up and pretty soon no one can move. But someone has an agenda that is served by illegal migration and not served by legal migration. Make no mistake about that. Who are the people that are served by lawlessness? Lawless people are the only people whose agenda is served by breaking down the barriers to illegal access to this country, while at the same time maintaining these onerous obstacles and barriers to legal migration. You need to think about this. I'm afraid many of our Mexican and other South American neighbors who are being encouraged by this administration to pour over our border illegally, they're being used as dupes. They are being used by the cartels to cover sneaking gang members, drugs, and guns across our borders. They are being used by terrorists to plant operatives in this country. They're being used by politicians here to increase their political power in this country. And when everyone's done using them, since they are conveniently illegal, well, then they can just get rid of them. All right? You need to watch out for that. But what do we do when we look at all these children and the young people flooding into this country who really are looking for a better life? And they're just kids being used as pawns in the hands of these criminal and evil people. No one should deny that that is a lot of what motivates this on the part of some of these kids and so on, their families. Most of these kids, I dare say, are not gang members or terrorists or have any agenda beyond finding a better life for themselves and their families. Everybody wants to move to Disneyland. There's a pastor in New York City's Lamb's Church who evidently keeps that church's doctrinal position pretty close to the vest because I can't find it. They don't show their cards, as they say. However, since he and his wife are co-pastors of that church, and the church is called the Lamb's Church, which is odd sounding to someone who thinks of the church as belonging to Christ, and that these pastors are both identified politically as progressive. I mean, they identify themselves in that way. And they are comfortable in venues that include La Raza, although I cannot find any direct connection between Seguero, Lamb's Church, or any of his organizations with La Raza. The assumption that he is a liberal theologically and politically is indeed a safe one. In fact, it's obvious. Last week, I mentioned that the Reverend Dr. Gabriel Seguero suggested that anyone that does not support amnesty is going to go to hell. And so let me follow up on that a little bit and expand on this and listen up. First, is this true? I won't take the time right now to read through his entire article, but I have read it. And so, and I can say that the answer to that first question is, well, no, that's actually not what he said in so many words. Although, it is possible to argue that he implied it when he likened those who disapprove of the illegal crossing of immigrants over our borders with those, in the text of Matthew 25, who refused to minister to Christ's children and were therefore cast into everlasting torment. That's where they get this idea that he was saying, if you don't support amnesty, you're on your way to hell. And I think an argument can be made for that, but he didn't say it in so many words. You understand what I'm saying? Second, let's face something here. If a conservative made such a reference to this passage and such an application of it in such a connection, well, he would have been tarred and feathered and branded a racist, a bigot, calling on people of a contrary political opinion to be cast into hell. I mean, it would never stop. But I'm going to be fair and honest about the whole thing. And he didn't, really just come off and say that. But let me address what he did say. Does the Reverend Seguero rightly use Matthew 25, 31 to 46? And the answer to that question is unequivocally no. First, the passage refers to the treatment by nations of those who are identified in the passage as Christ's sheep, to believers, to Christians. And so technically, the passage is not about how we treat the poor and the needy, but rather how we treat Christ's sheep. Second, when any of Christ's sheep violate the law and are taken into custody. Well, the Bible tells us Jesus is more strict on them than the law typically would be. So, although the Reverend misses the real point of the passage, we should not miss the point he's attempting to make with it. He desires to challenge our conscience to consider, how can we look past the tears on the faces of these children and not respond sympathetically and with compassion? And so I rephrase the question a little bit to refocus it where it really ought to be focused. The question is, how can we look past the tears on the faces of these children to see that extending mercy to them actually perverts justice and really is not mercy, but is cruelty. It is a liberal device to put forward a call to mercy ahead of justice and judgment, to exalt mercy above justice and judgment. Now, you gotta listen carefully. First, liberals twist a lot of scripture into all sorts of distortions that open the doors to hell, to minister to us all sorts of evil, to spew up out of its bowels all manner of evil. And it ends up encouraging and strengthening evil in our country rather than deterring it. And they do this in a great many ways. But one constant, one device that is used, purposely, cleverly, or I think in most cases, ignorantly, is this trick of getting mercy in front of justice. It is an understandable mistake for people who are ignorant of Scripture. Lots of Scriptures suggest that God desires mercy above all other things. Matthew 9:13, "But go ye and learn what that meaneth. I will have mercy and not sacrifice, for I am not come to call the righteous but sinners to repentance." And Matthew 5:7, "Blessed are the merciful, for they shall obtain mercy." And James 2:13, "For he shall have judgment without mercy that hath showed no mercy, and mercy rejoiceth against judgment." However, it is superficial to leap into conclusions from these verses and decide that God puts mercy or exalts mercy above and puts it before judgment. God never puts mercy above justice and judgment. My friend, it is the other way around. This is not to say God does not cherish mercy, perhaps even more than judgment, but he never compromises judgment and justice for the sake of mercy. Let me explain. Notice that virtually every time mercy is mentioned in the Bible, it is always mentioned in connection with justice and judgment. Psalm 89:14, "Justice and judgment are the habitation of thy throne. Mercy and truth shall go before thy face." Psalm 101:1, "I will sing of mercy and judgment. Unto thee, O Lord, will I sing." Isaiah 16:5, "And in mercy shall the throne be established, and he shall sit upon it in truth in the tabernacle of David, judging and seeking judgment and hasting righteousness." Isaiah 30:18, "And therefore will the Lord wait that he may be gracious unto you, and therefore will he be exalted," listen, "that he may have mercy upon you. For the Lord is a God of judgment. Blessed are they that wait for him." Hosea 12:6, "Therefore turn thou to thy God, keep mercy and judgment, and wait on thy God continually. Thus speaketh the Lord of hosts, saying, execute true judgment and show mercy and compassions every man to his brother." Matthew 23:23, "Woe unto you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for ye pay tithe of mint and anise and cumin, and have omitted the weightier matters of the law." And he names them judgment, mercy, and faith. "These ought ye to have done, and not to leave the other undone." Notice that in the analogy of faith, judgment in the Bible consistently has to be satisfied or addressed before mercy can be extended. A great example of that is the tabernacle itself. Look at it, look how it was constructed. Exodus chapters 25 through 40. The mercy seat, where was it located? Was it out there in the yard? You know, at the very front door, the front entry into the area of the tabernacle? No. No, that was an altar of the burnt offering. That's where judgment was satisfied. You know where mercy was kept? Behind the veil of the temple, in the Holy of Holies, protected, shielded. And nobody was able to walk in there except the priest once a year, and then not without blood. You see, you understand? From God's point of view, judgment and justice must be satisfied before you even approach mercy. Mercy is something granted only to the humble, by the way. The proud are resisted. James 4:6, 1 Peter 5:5, with Proverbs 3:34 and Hebrews 4:16. Don't have time to read all those. We come humbly to obtain mercy. And the reason, by the way, that we may come for mercy is this: Jesus Christ on the cross of Calvary has satisfied the demands of justice and judgment. Notice the conditional basis of mercy. Mercy isn't extended unconditionally. Paul argued that although he was a blasphemer and a persecutor and injurious, he nevertheless obtained mercy because he did it ignorantly in unbelief, 1 Timothy 1:13. So in his thinking, there was a basis for this mercy being extended to him. It's a general principle of Scripture. Mercy is precious and not just thrown out there. And God will not allow it to be sullied or soiled by sentimentality, because sentimentality perverts justice. To use mercy to pervert justice spoils mercy and makes it the servant of evil and not of righteousness. It allows all sorts of evil to enter into our lives. Consider how much evil comes into your own life and family through a sentimental idea of extending mercy and failing to discipline your children as you ought. Consider how much you ruin them, by the way. Consider how much evil enters into the world through evil men manipulating the sentiment of the compassionate in order to get them to compromise judgment and justice. You see it everywhere in liberal culture, especially manipulation of Christians' sentiment in favor of mercy, in order to position them so they pervert justice and judgment, and all of this at the price of cheapening mercy, making it and recruiting it and forcing it, compelling it to become a servant of evil rather than a servant of good. Okay, we got to move in the direction of a conclusion here. What is the basis then for mercy toward those who are crossing our borders illegally? Well, the basis needs to be an enforcement of the laws. It should be done with a view to mercy, but the law should be enforced. Not cruelly, but efficiently, effectively, they need to be enforced. The right response would be to look past the emotional appeals and see the issues of justice and judgment that are raised here and address those issues, satisfy those concerns, and then extend mercy in an appropriate way. Otherwise, if you, for example, grant blanket mercy, by granting blanket amnesty, let's say, well, you'll do great damage to justice and judgment, and evil will take full advantage of that. In fact, that's exactly what is happening right now. Obama's approach provides cover, comfort, and support for evil. Evil is taking advantage of a predisposition in this country among liberals to respond with sentimental mercy to this kind of a situation. And that will compromise judgment and justice and break law and order and create more evil and do more damage to these children than good. And it encourages evil to take advantage of their sentimentality. And we're making this country more and more vulnerable to evil every time we approach this thing by breaking the laws and encouraging the breaking of laws. In the end, it will not serve the children. It will only serve the emotional pride and self-righteousness of the liberal. The children are the ones who are most hurt by this kind of cruel mercy. Indeed, mercy without justice and judgment, it becomes a weakness that can be exploited by evil. I hope you understand that. It's a veritable door for evil to flow strong and like a torrent into the world and into our country and ravage the innocent. The very innocent they're trying to protect are the ones most vulnerable to being hurt by all this in the end. So what should we do in this situation? Well, we should turn these children back to their parents. We should give them safe passage back to their homes. I believe that, as a matter of fact, Mexico should be called upon to pay for this whole mess. They should protect their side of our mutual borders. Let's put it this way. They have as much responsibility to protect the integrity of their side of the border as we do to protect the integrity of our side. We cannot legitimately allow their evil to exploit our sentimentality, since that will only serve in the end to strengthen and encourage more of this kind of evil behavior. Enforce justice and judgment, then please have mercy and look seriously at the legal process of immigration and look at ways to help the Mexican economy, by the way, and these other economies. And the first step there would be to break the power of the cartels over the government. Hey, instead of giving guns to the cartels, how about we give guns to the citizens and offer to give them some training and help them defend themselves from these wicked people? Thank you, Pat. I have lit the lamps in the church belfry arch, and now you call and let me know you see that they are on. Call 1-888-770-8000. That is 1-888-770-8000. Now, for those from outside the country or who prefer it, you may email me by going to theraymassageshow.com. That's www.thebrainmassageshow.com. Tell me lights on or lights off, and then write as long a letter as you like, and I want to hear from you. So God bless you, God save America, and I'll see you in church.
Calling all Lights On listeners to The Brain Massage Show. Keep the lights on. Go to www.thebrainmassageshow.com and make your donation today. Or mail it to P.O. Box 2803, Santa Maria, California, 93457.
For a complete brain massage experience, tune in Saturdays at 7:30 a.m.